on this edition of the program. What demographic has won every American presidential election from 2000 until today? We discuss with the one and only Evan Scrimshaw. It's all coming up.
This is made possible by Bluefront and the Lenina. Owe Them Bones. Daily Tech News Show. V and Craig.
Welcome, everybody, to the Politics program for April 19th, 2024. Your old pal, Justin Robert Young, joining you here in Austin, Texas. What's going to follow is an interview that, conversation with a friend, Evan Scrimshaw. We talk about demographics, a lot of conversation about demographics over the last few days. Black Americans, Hispanic Americans, old Americans, young Americans, very much in play. How much will be actually changed by the time that people go to the polls in November? We don't know. But we can look in the past, and that's why we welcome our friend Evan Scrimshaw. Here's our interview. Demographics. That is the big topic. There was a great deep dive on Split Ticket earlier this week about the youth vote, how it is being polled, and the danger of diving into crosstabs. But we wanted to go back and visit some of the stories in the past. What are the demographics that actually turned the election from this vantage point in 2024? And to do any kind of digging into those polls, we need to talk to our friend, Evan Scrimshaw. Welcome back, Evan.
Thanks for having me, man. And I just want to say congratulations on the news that you dropped on Tuesday night.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Greatly, greatly appreciated. So this is something that it's a very nerdy pursuit, but I do think it's going to be helpful because especially this year, there do seem to be some kind of demographic shifts. There are coalitional realignments that are happening in both parties. We don't know exactly how impactful they will be. My guess is that we're going to talk a lot more about them than they will actually turn out in November. But before we get into the history of it, what is your sense of the actual demographic state of play in both the Republican and Democratic coalitions?
It makes sense that there would be some amount of demographic change. It makes sense because the Democratic coalition has always been heavily dependent on culturally conservative minorities who disagree with the DC, New York, LA elites to some degree, who have voted for the Democratic Party because of issues specific to race. For Hispanic voters, it's been immigration. For Black voters, it's been gestures of the GOP's history. And so it makes sense the Democrats would have some slippage with these voters. It also makes sense that the GOP, which is more reliant on voters who disagree with their abortion stance, there are more pro-choice Republicans than there are pro-life Democrats left, would have some slippage now that Dobbs has happened and the GOP position on abortion is a real reality as opposed to just a theoretical potential problem. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that those shifts that we saw in 2020, minorities getting a bit more Republican, educated voters getting substantially more Democratic, it makes sense that that would continue. The thing is, the polls are saying it's going to continue to the nth degree. And
yes,
a lot of people, including that very good Split Ticket write-up, suggest that it might not be quite what the polls say. And certainly a lot of what we're seeing in oversamples of Hispanic voters, Black voters, and young voters suggests that it will not be as sharp, even if the trends are still there.
But then again, in an election that was decided over the last two by hundreds of thousands of votes, you don't really need much of a turn on either side. In 2016, it was Rust Belt voters that had been more Democratic. And in 2020, it was the suburban voters that went for Biden that can turn these. But that's what we want to talk about here. And we don't want to talk about the things that have already done. We will get back to 2016 and 2020, but I want to go all the way back to the dawn of the millennium, the 2000 election. I think this one is pretty rock solid that Palm Beach Jews determined the election, considering this came down to 500 votes that were largely counted in a heavily Democratic precinct. What is your thought?
I mean, my snarky answer is going to be lawyers determine the 2000 election, many of which would also qualify as Palm Beach Jews.
Palm Beach Jews. Yeah.
Given how bad Al Gore's legal argument in 2000 was. I mean, the thing about any super close election, and obviously 2000 is the closest, but there have been a few of them, is that like kind of everything is responsible, right? Because
yeah,
and 2000 was abnormal because it wasn't just Florida that was super close. Like four or five states were within a point. You know, that map could have shaken out 12,000 different ways. We're recording this the day after Bob Graham died, which is also like Al Gore pick up your VP, and you're probably president of the United States right now. So. But yeah, I think Florida, and I definitely think Palm Beach Jews is a reasonable answer to that question, especially because then it doesn't duplicate my answer for 2000 and 2004, which we'll get into in a minute.
So, and that's such a fascinating election that I do feel like gets overshadowed by the end, by the fact that there was this extraordinarily rare, you know, very legally contested, the Supreme Court steps in. A lot of the ink and a lot of the history has been spilled on that, but you're right. Joe Lieberman might not have been the best vice presidential pick. We saw, you know, George W. Bush had a huge challenge from John McCain in that primary that seemed to show that coalition was possibly not as strong. He was not the same candidate in 2000 that we remember from post 9/11, because that very much shifted at least what he was running on at the time. So I don't know. I do kind of feel like 2000 is very much worth another deep dive by somebody at some point.
Well, and it's also an election that was watershed, right? It was the first time Republicans won West Virginia. It showed a further decline in that sort of historically Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Southern South. And then even obviously before Carter and Clinton, but like, it showed a certain decline there. I mean, we all forget about it because Wisconsin never voted for Republican presidentially for all those years. But I mean, Bush got it within a point in 2000. You know, like it's one of those elections that really the end has overshadowed it. And frankly, if they had just gotten the result in Florida right on the night, and there wasn't the shenanigans, and Jeb Bush wasn't the governor of Florida, and his brother was running for president. Like, if all of that stuff didn't happen and therefore lead to Democrats being, you could argue legitimately, I'm not going to argue about Bush v. Gore, but like, you know, unhinged about this election, there is a lot of really interesting parts in it. And it's frankly far more interesting than 2004, which people seem to find more interesting, which I don't really understand.
Yeah. So, all right, let's move to 2004. The Iraq war is in full swing. You have American service people coming back in pine boxes. That the glow of George W. Bush being the most popular president of all time and firing a strike over the plate in Yankee Stadium has faded a bit. And yet we find ourselves in 2004 at possibly the last moment of the true cultural conservative movement. The wedge issue is gay marriage. You see a lot of chicanery toward the end of the race with Dan Rather and Memogate. In your opinion, what is the demographic that swung that election?
Social conservatives who were driven to the polls in a lot of swing states by these gay marriage bans that Karl Rove and the conservative machine got on the ballot. It's, in my view, Bush would have lost Ohio, and that would have been enough to lose him the presidency, if not for the fact that they had supercharged that campaign not just by putting the ballot question on there, but by sort of amping up the rhetoric around gay marriage, by using it as an incredibly effective wedge issue at a time when gay marriage was still the public were not on board on gay marriage, which honestly just makes it shocking. The public got on board as quickly as it did, but like, that was a incredibly ruthless campaign by the right to use a political wedge issue to their advantage. And that wasn't the campaign, because it kept Ohio red at a time when, like, the other story of that election was Bush did incredibly well with Hispanics. But the thing is, none of those states were close. Florida wasn't close. Yeah. Texas wasn't close. Arizona wasn't close. Like, the two stories were the social conservatives in the Rust Belt, who stayed red because of gay rights, and Hispanics, and the Hispanics weren't electoral college useful.
Yeah, you know, there was also a lot of conversation with safety moms. Safety moms was a big thing that the Bush campaign was targeting as their big thing of John Kerry will allow the war on terror to spiral into an awful position. And you need a steady hand at the wheel while we are essentially, well, they were in wartime. You know, whether or not it was a popular war is a different story, but we were deployed with American troops in a foreign nation. But I agree with you. I do think that the cultural issue of gay marriage, which seems very foreign 20 years on, you know, 20 years on, we are looking at a world in which we had a bipartisan codification via Congress for gay marriage in America, something that was thought to be absolutely unheard of 20 years ago.
I mean, everyone forgets this. Sodomy laws were only fully struck down across the U.S. in 2003. And that was a decision. Lawrence v. Texas was not a controversial decision in 2003. Like, which is just stunning when you think about the fact that by 2015, you had the court rule gay marriage was legal across the country. And by 2022, you had codification. It's incredible how quickly that happened and how it's gone from this issue that only a certain sect of left-wing politicians would handle. You know, you had a veto-proof majority for DOMA in 98, and then we're at, and then 15 years later, we're at, you know, public majorities and the court, a conservative court coming to the defense of gay couples. It's remarkable how quickly that moved.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, that's something where you could probably, we could probably do another 2 hours just unpacking that cultural conversation on why the needle moved as fast as it did. But let's move on to 2008. This is the birth of the Obama coalition, something that we are still looking at the Biden campaign now trying to figure out what Frankenstein version of it they can either keep together or replace with different parts. What is the demographic that wins the 2008 presidential election?
Supercharged minority turnout. It not only won him the election by putting Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania basically out of commission for McCain, although a financial crisis did definitely help. But that was the election that flipped Colorado, Virginia, you know, Florida, you know, super saved the Florida Democratic Party. Like, don't forget, 2004 was a blowout. 2006 was not a good gubernatorial. Like, the Florida Democrats were in a bad way then. Obama came in. They invested a ton of money, ton of energy on minority outreach. And 2008 is really the legacy of that. I mean, Democrats got close enough that a Georgia Senate race in 2008 went to a runoff, and then Obama didn't do anything with that runoff. And, you know, arguably that Senate seat would have been valuable to have in fighting his legacy, but, you know, that was, I think, really the thing. It was minority turnout sort of, and it led to this sort of, it was a high watermark that hasn't been replicated, but everyone wants to replicate. Everyone wants to go back to the halcyon days of 2008 when you know, you just when it was somewhat reasonable to suggest that if you just boost minority turnout enough, you don't have to that can just be your supercharged strategy to win elections. The problem, of course, with that is those voters then don't show up in either midterm and Obama gets massacred twice.
Well, and it seems like now we can safely say that this was an Obama phenomenon, that having a very young, exciting, articulate, dare I say clean and nice, a black man be your nominee is something that supercharges minority turnout that's hard to replicate when Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden are at the top of the ticket.
Yeah, for sure. And the lack of anything even close to replication has been stunning. Like, it doesn't seem to matter what circumstances it comes in. It doesn't seem to matter what conditions arise. It's functionally impossible for anybody to even come close to replicating it. And even some of the great Democratic gubernatorial results in states that Obama did really well in via black turnout, you know, it's not like Gretchen Whitmer has won Michigan by double digits twice through supercharging black turnout. It's actually just been frankly mediocre results in Detroit and amazing results everywhere else, which makes it, I mean, the only person who's really come close, you would say, is maybe Raphael Warnock in Georgia. Yeah. But even then, he's got to run against Kelly Loeffler and Herschel Walker.
So Herschel Walker. Not exactly. That they are not sending their best, as a philosopher once said. That being said, and let's take a really quick detour here, because you mentioned Warnock. It's been so fascinating watching these Senate races, which you do see a separation between the Democratic candidates in some of these Senate races, say for Maryland, and the top of the ticket, where there's a huge gap between the Republican candidate and Trump. But it was interesting watching in Ohio, the sitting Democratic senators, a first ad, because it reminded me so much of Raphael Warnock's campaign, where he, you would never know what party he's in, because he never says it. He certainly doesn't mention the president of the United States. He just says, look at this project I'm doing. Boy, is that a great project. I'm a really nice guy with a good smile. I work with Republicans. Vote for me. And that won Raphael Warnock his seat.
Yeah, but that won Raphael Warnock his seat in a state that voted 8 points left of Ohio in 2020. Sherrod is trying so hard to replicate the like 90s 2000 strategy of good for the state. You know who I am.
Yep.
Don't trust an outsider, which really did work at a time of much lower polarization and has mostly not worked since then. Like, Democrats tried this in Montana in 2020 with Steve Bullock, and you know, that didn't get anywhere. I know he wasn't incumbent, but he wasn't incumbent governor at the time. Phil Bredesen tried this in 2018. I'm still skeptical that Larry Hogan's going to pull it off for the same reason, which is just partisanship is so much higher. Polarization is so much higher and federal races are really hard to win. And that's the double-edged sword for him, which is that he's trying to pull off something that other than Susan Collins hasn't been done since 2012, which is win as an incumbent in a state that did that at the same time on the same ticket votes for the other party for president. And that I think is the sort of optimistic case and also the concerning case for Democrats across the whole Senate map, which is if a Biden can get his numbers to a point where he's winning Nevada, where he's winning Michigan, where he's winning Wisconsin, there are good Senate Democrats in all those, you know, states. But he needs to get his numbers to a point, because if Biden loses those states by 2, 3, 4, that might be enough to wipe out a Tammy Baldwin, a Jackie Rosen, why am I blanking on the Denver, a Slotkin up in Michigan. And that would be the concern in turning a presidential loss into not just a presidential loss, but a 6-year Senate loss.
And that's the reality, is that right now this map is very high stakes for the Republican side. Like, this is a once in a generation map for them, that especially with Trump at the top of the ticket, you're not going to have a problem with turnout. This is an extraordinarily advantageous map. And if you don't, if they don't lock in whatever gains they're going to get now, it's only going to get rougher from here over the next few cycles.
Well, if you look at 2026, which is the Senate map that was up in 2020, where are Republicans really going to make gains? Maybe Brian Kemp runs for Senate against John Ossoff. Maybe. But one, we've thought a lot of former governors might run for Senate. We thought Doug Ducey might run. We thought Kristi Noonan might run in 2022. Neither of them did. Maybe Kemp takes a pass on it. But other than that, Colorado? No.
Nope.
New Hampshire? No. Like,
yeah, probably not.
Like, there just isn't this like great suite of Republican gain opportunities, and they're going to have to play real defense. They have to defend Susan Collins, who might retire and might stay home. They've got to defend Tom Tillis in North Carolina, and they've got to defend Dan Sullivan. And I don't think Alaska is particularly a swing state at this point, but Mary Peltola exists, and she might fancy a promotion. So Republicans have to, like, they can't be content with winning the Senate. Right. They can't be content with 52 seats.
No, they have to build a lead or else this is going to go away in the midterms, where if Trump wins, which is their hope, that's their hope for building a lead here, then they're probably going to get slaughtered in the midterms anyway.
A Republican year with what would be functionally a 6-year midterm for Trump with that Senate map. Like, you're talking about Republicans having to defend things that they don't even,
that they wouldn't normally.
Right. And I mean, that in that case, you could just give Democrats Susan Collins a seat. She probably wouldn't even run again. Like, so that's going to be interesting. But this is a huge opportunity. And that's the thing about Senate seats, is that because it's a 6-year term, you got to get it right. And the line between failure and between being ecstatic and being devastated, I think, is going to be pretty narrow in a lot of these seats.
So if I hear you right, then that means you are a little bit bearish on some of the polls that show Democrats up in those states that have been edging Republican or are solidly red, like Ohio. But you are also bearish on Larry Hogan, which right now he's opening up like double digit leads on both of the Democratic candidates as they enter their primary.
Correct.
This is your update brought to you by TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That's where you go if you want to sign up for our Patreon. At the $3 level, you get 2 podcasts each and every week. I don't know if you guys heard, but my wife is pregnant. I'm going to be a father for the first time in my life. I've never sired a child before, but that will change in August. This podcasting game of mine is right now the only way that we make money in this house, because my wife was let go in the tech winter that has enveloped that industry. So I just want to say, before we get to our update, that not only is TakePoliticsSeriously.com a place for which you can get bonus content, 2 episodes each and every week delivered in both audio and video form, trying to step our game up here for you guys, but it is also literally the thing that is keeping everything going. And we feel strong enough that we are allowed to do it because of you. So if you are so motivated, you can head on over there right now. $3 level gets you those 2 bonus podcasts. But I just want to, before we get into the news, say thanks. But we're here to get into the news, so let's do that. Via Politico, a full panel of 12 jurors have been chosen for Donald Trump's hush money trial. 7 jurors were quickly sworn in this afternoon, filling the panel that will decide whether Trump is guilty of falsifying business documents to conceal a sex scandal with a porn star. We have our jury, said Justice Juan Merchan, when the 12th juror was picked. One alternate juror is also selected. Up to 5 more alternates will be chosen. The selection advanced swiftly this afternoon after 2 jurors who had been seated on Tuesday were unexpectedly dismissed earlier in the day. The reason why was because Trump lawyer Susan Nicheles presented vitriolic social media posts made by one of those jurors. The Post included one from 2016 saying, quote, "We need to stop the election of a racist, sexist, narcissist." And another from 2017 saying, "I wouldn't believe Trump if his tongue were notarized." Says Nichelis. This woman harbors, at least until 2020 when she stopped posting because of COVID, that she harbors a deep hatred of him. Him being Trump in this case. After the woman said under further questioning that she now disavowed some of those views and apologized to Trump for the language, Mershon said it was a close call, but viewed as a whole, I don't think we need to take a chance with this juror. A lot of eyes, obviously, on this trial. The first time that we have seen a former president tried for a felony. One of the prospective jurors has a son that apparently works in Hakeem Jeffries' office. That was tweeted and deleted by Olivia Nuzzi of New York Magazine. There are apparently two lawyers that are on the jury, suggesting that there could possibly be a technicality defense that will be put forward by the Trump team. My suspicion is that Trump will be convicted here. You know, the people that they are weeding out are folks who have not led a particularly quiet existence when it comes to their opinions on Donald Trump. And if you look at the folks who voted in New York City, they aren't exactly Trump fans. You know, unless you go to Staten Island or Queens. But we will see how this goes. We do know now that at the very least, we got 12. Speaker Mike Johnson has decided against pursuing changes to the motion to vacate rule, a decision that has had significant implications amid ongoing tensions within the GOP. The current rule allows any one single House member to force a vote on removing the speaker, a provision that has recently been under intense scrutiny. Johnson's decision to back away comes in the wake of pressure from conservative factions within his party, notably after discussions on using a rule change in the foreign aid legislation to increase the threshold for such motions. This only came after many hardline conservative threats, including Representative Lauren Boebert and Representative Matt Gaetz, two firebrands that had not commented a lot on Marjorie Taylor Greene's push to vacate Johnson. Both expressed strong opposition to any modification of the motion to vacate rule, viewing it as an essential accountability weapon. Their concerns were amplified by the backdrop of the Ukraine aid debate, during which Johnson's leadership style and negotiation tactics with Democrats have been criticized by members of his own party. In particular, Gaetz has been very vocal about maintaining the current rule, underscoring its importance as a check on leadership. He was very clear about that today, saying that he did not wake up today wanting to vacate the speaker, but if the speaker wants to move the goalposts, then, well, he could get there. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's been a vocal critic of Johnson, has already filed the motion to vacate against him, reacted strongly against the potential rule change, accusing Johnson of making secretive deals with the Democrats to safeguard his position. Controversy over the rule changes proposal highlights ongoing fractures in the GOP. So this morning, we are recording this on Thursday. This morning, we recorded the Patreon that you get if you're a patron, $3 level, and mentioned that Johnson was going to do this and that Marjorie Taylor Greene was screaming about it. Within a couple hours, Johnson had backed off. And it's largely because he wound up causing a bigger problem than he had on his hands before. Before, he, you know, you had a kind of settle down caucus that was emerging that didn't believe that the Republicans needed this kind of chaos. And by the end of the day, after the hardliners emerged saying, whoa, we don't want that changed, Matt Gaetz not only pushed hard to get it included, but also vacated Kevin McCarthy with it. I gotta say, I have a lot of sympathy for Speaker Johnson. Nobody wanted that job. It might be the hardest job in Washington, but that was, kind of feel like an unforced error. And finally, The Biden administration has imposed new sanctions on Iran, targeting the nation's drone, steel, and auto industries as a punitive measure for Iran's recent missile and drone attack on Israel. This decision reflects a strategic choice to counter Iran's aggressive actions economically rather than escalating military tensions. Announced by the Treasury Department, these sanctions involve coordination with the UK, which is also focused on Iran's drone and ballistic missile capabilities. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen emphasized that the sanctions are part of a conservative effort to degrade and disrupt Iran's harmful activities, particularly the UAV program and the financial resources it employs to support its terrorist activities. These remarks came after Yellen hinted at the impending sanctions earlier this week. Here's my question. How effective are these? And I don't ask that leading. I just know that, you know, we put the harshest sanctions we could, quote unquote, on Russia after Ukraine. And, you know, I'm sure that Russia is worse off. But how much? How much can be backfilled by other countries? And exactly how much interaction did the United States have with Iran before? Obviously, this is going to lead to conservative answers to stuff like that with, well, hey, I got a sanction for you. Maybe don't give them billions of dollars. How about that? But we'll see how it plays out. Here's how I know that we are going to play out. And that is by reminding you one more time, takepoliticsseriously.com is where you go. $3 level gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week in audio, in video, and anywhere else that we can possibly do it. Friends, we're here for you. Takepoliticsseriously.com. Well, let's move into 2012. This is Obama's reelect against Mitt Romney. What is the demographic that wins the election?
Rust Belt working class whites. This is the Democratic last stand with those voters, right? Romney did pretty substantially worse in northern white, actually in both northern and southern working class areas. Compared to McCain, his private equity background was a huge problem. The Bain Capital stuff. There's the famous Priorities. I think it was Priorities stage ad about how Romney had these factory workers sort of create their own, the stage on which he announced their layoffs was hugely effective. Romney was a better candidate than McCain in the suburbs. He was a much worse candidate in exurban and working class regional America. Democrats had this is why Democrats thought they had this enduring Electoral College majority, even if the popular vote got wonky in 2016, because Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin all voted like 2 points left of the nation. Like it was a blue year, but those states were incredibly blue. And then we'll get into 2016, where I think everyone knows the answer, but that was a really blue year, and that was a really, really strong performance from Democrats with working class voters.
And this is one of the counterfactuals to a long-held belief that I've had in campaigns, that I would rather have a really violent primary because I do believe that it tends to make stronger candidates, except in 2012. Because you mentioned that this is white working class voters that turned this election, and it wasn't just that stage ad that starts it. It's Newt Gingrich in the primary. He creates this effective ad. Mr. Romney came to town, and it absolutely sings to that voter that he is just a robber baron from an old movie who comes in, dismantles your town, and then leaves so he can make 5 cents more than he would otherwise. Totally paints him as this soulless Mr. Burns capitalist. And then Obama and all the PACs there take it and run with it. And the reason why I think it was effective is the caveat that I would say in a very violent primary is that you want a violent primary so you build calluses for your weaknesses. You want to be able to respond to the things that are negative to you. And it's why coronation primaries, I think, tend to create overconfidence. And then when things start leaking in the general and it's harder to fix it and people have defined views on you, it becomes more of a problem. But in this case, Romney didn't do anything. He squeaks by Newt Gingrich because he's Newt Gingrich, and then can't in any way redefine himself or find a way to make it better.
Well, that I mean, so Romney's campaign was like the first that I like truly, truly paid attention to. And so, like, I remember thinking this contemporaneously, but that campaign had no idea what to do, had no idea how to treat bank capital, right? It didn't know whether to treat his business history as something to be lauded and something to sort of take advantage of. And it didn't know what to do when it was attacked. And it never made a decision. It never decided whether or not it was something he was going to run away from. He never decided if he was the business guy, if he was the moderate governor of Massachusetts persona, or the guy who would run in two straight Republican primaries. It never made a decision. And that campaign died on the vine of just complete inability to make a decision. And I think I actually agree with your competitive primaries point, mostly because the act of being attacked by your own side generally makes you make decisions. It makes you decide on a strategy. Yes. It lets you test drive some strategies, see what works, see what focus groups like and don't like. And then you decide on the lane. Romney never couldn't make a decision. That campaign was anemic. And it was, you know, sort of from a narrative standpoint, saved by the fact that Romney can be really, really good. Like that first debate.
Yeah.
Was amazing from Romney and terrifying for my, you know, 15-year-old liberal, super liberal self. But like that was a campaign that was sort of premised on the idea that Mitt can solve the problems of our strategy because he's so personable. And yeah, he actually is really quite personable. And that debate performance was incredible. But that debate performance wasn't enough to undo the damage of 6 months of dithering and delaying and being unable to decide who they were and what his actual message was.
And yeah, running away from the fact that he's rich and he, you know, was involved in these businesses. It's like you have to own it. That's who you are. You're the guy. If you run Bain Capital, then you're the guy who creates jobs. And whenever anybody says that you were involved in cutting a job, you say, hey, the business wasn't profitable. That's what happens to unprofitable businesses. Here are the jobs that I created. Did I ever tell you, I ran into the woman who made the binder full of women.
No, you haven't told me this.
I was at an event and I was talking to people and it winds up coming up and she's like, yeah, I spent my entire summer working to vet qualified female candidates because Romney came in and said that we want to put more women in positions of power. This was an absolute win for him. And it turns into this loss. And she was just talking about how heartbroken she felt as she's just watching all the stuff come in on Twitter about LOL, LOL, binders full of women. She's just like, oh, my life's work falling apart in my hands.
That is something that, like, with hindsight is absolutely the funniest controversy because it was portrayed as like him being a sexist when it was actually very much not. And it's just it is funny is the only word to me how badly he screwed up delivering a point that is actually quite good. And I think now that line would go over like, oh, you're trying. You're making sure to prioritize looking at female candidates to, you know, I feel like that line would go over much differently. And if it was slightly better presented,
well,
now
2012 has a few of those up to and including Russia called, they want their foreign policy, or the '80s called, they want their foreign policy back, considering how much the Democratic Party has keyed in on Russia over the last few years. But let's move in to our modern era. 2016, probably one of the most studied elections in our modern history. It reignites an entire, pretty much the first time that the monoculture now entirely revolves around politics because of how loud that campaign was, because of the Trump effect, and because it was a shift in demographics. What is the one that won that election?
It's many of the same voters who voted for Obama in 2012 shifting to Donald Trump. I tell the story a lot, but in the summer of 2013, me and my mother did a road trip through Ohio, and on the way back, instead of just taking the I-71 from Cleveland to Cincinnati and then back, we went east for a while and then went north to Columbus, and we got lunch in this Applebee's in Ross County, Ohio, a county that voted for Romney by a point in 2012. This was an Applebee's that had Fox News on TV, where the N-word was flying around like it was nobody's business, where homophobic slurs were being used to describe Obama with regularity. That county that, again, had voted for Romney by a point, voted for Trump by 25 points. That is the sort of the county south of the I-71 are sort of my cultural touchstone for it, because I lived it in that trip. But, you know, regional areas, places that have been left behind, take your pick of adjectives, places where Democrats sort of preachy social liberalism doesn't play very well. The thing is that the suburbs definitely did move left in that election as the rural areas trended, you know, swung heavily right. But the suburbs didn't move enough left to offset the big move right amongst working class voters. And that's why Trump gets just barely over the line. And Hillary has bad, really bad minority turnout. So that can't bail it out. But it's the working class shifts. They were huge, 20, 30 points in some counties.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does show you what, in some ways, kind of Obama did of being able to really, really, really supercharge a demographic that was not supercharged before, that our very same copycat world of politics, which never really believes that anything's going to move more than a few points one way or another. Sometimes you can just get those earthquakes and it's just not on the maps. And certainly that wasn't it for Hillary. Much has been written. I'd highly recommend that people read the book Shattered about the inside the Obama camp, or sorry, the Clinton campaign, of how, you know, somewhere between ignorant and arrogant they were believing that this was even possible.
Yeah. And I mean, it was a case where it was an incredibly, where there was evidence of some of the movement, but nowhere close to the scale. And, you know, a lot of that was bad polling, and a lot of it was sort of just overestimating that the minority turnout stuff would continue, that it wasn't really an Obama effect, which we now know it really to have been. But the other thing is, you know, I think people just refuse to believe that these voters would actually swing that much, you know, even though that was what the Trump campaign was saying, you know, oh, we're going to win the Rust Belt. We're going to create a Rust Belt strategy. I mean, frankly, I mean, it's been widely reported that neither campaign thought Trump was going to win. Neither campaign's internal data actually thought he'd get over the line. And the other false hope is that, like, Michigan voted for Obama the second time by like 9 points. Like, Democrats had huge leads in all these presidential states. None of them had voted for Republicans since 88 at the latest, right? So there was a lot of arrogance in that campaign that, you know, that whatever problems exist weren't there. And, you know, there were signs, but frankly, by the time the signs were there, the campaign had made its problems. And because the polls were that good, and because of Access Hollywood and a bunch of things, you know, Clinton spent time in Arizona and Georgia and North Carolina and, you know, trying to win some Senate seats and run up the score. And it turned out she needed to be playing a way more defensive map, and she didn't know.
Yeah. Now, with that being said, we now move into 2020. So let me just ask you this before we get into the demographics, as we are moving into this cycle and we are trying to use the best data that we can to model this electorate, how much do you count 2020 considering everything that was going on? We're still in a lockdown. The mood of the country is crazy. We had this anomalous dip for the American economy, cosplaying as the Great Depression for a month and a half. How much do you count what happened in 20? How seriously do you take the 2020 numbers in general?
Fairly seriously, just because outside of a few places where they might have been anomalous, Vegas being one of them, so Texas being another, they actually mostly make sense. they're like 2020 was mostly just take 2016 trends and continue them, except that this time Republicans had less room to gain with white working class, with white non-college voters, and Democrats had a lot of room to gain with suburban educated voters. But 2020 wasn't actually really that anomalous. It's kind of what you would have said if you had just given somebody the 2016 results, said Biden's going to win by 4.5 nationally instead of Hillary's 2.1, and extend the trends from 2016 on. It wasn't that anomalous in aggregate. I think there are places where we don't know a lot, and those areas tend to be working class areas where a lot of the population are not white. So you're talking about places like Vegas, South Texas, Houston, I think is going to be potentially interesting to see whether or not that turnout surge of lower propensity Hispanics who voted for Trump, whether they're going to come back out again. But 2020 was less wonky than it almost should have been. You know, there wasn't any like wacky Senate race that was won or lost on COVID politics. I mean, you could maybe argue Susan Collins. That's not that wonky. That's a wonky state electing its popular incumbent again. Like, there wasn't, it frankly wasn't as wonky as it should have been, probably, looking back.
Yeah. The one thing that I don't know is just turnout. Turnout where you had so much mail-in, you had so much Dropbox stuff, you had, and also you had nothing else to do. It was the only thing that anybody was talking about or thinking about in a way that I, obviously it's going to be the number one story going into 24. The noise is going to be extraordinarily loud. I just don't know if it is going to be entirely myopic where the only thing that's on television, the only thing that's live, your paycheck is revolving around the government. Your news is Trump coming out to his coronavirus rallies in the press room. It seemed to supercharge all of Trump's defects and allowed Biden to sit in his basement and just say, well, at least I'm not that guy. Literally say in the debate, won't this guy shut up? Boom, put it on a bumper sticker. That's going to supercharge every demographic that you need to win this election.
Yeah. I think the reason I'm not focusing on the turnout effect, which was real. I mean, Trump got what, like 11 million more votes, 10 million more votes than he did in 2016. Like Biden got 15 million more than Hillary, like, is because it seems like the higher you crank turnout at this point, the better it is for Republicans. And so therefore, if you assume that 2024 is going to be lower turnout than 2020, that disproportionately helps Biden. The thing is that I don't really want to make that argument because, that could be true, but like, I don't, but it's so far away. And I think that a lot of the, one of the things that you can get very wrong, as I did in 2020, is looking at turnout and assuming that we know who the voters who will or won't turn out are. And just because something's just, and frankly, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm making incredibly confident predictions about more things than I need to in mid-April. Because, you know, frankly, if we look at the last, you know, four sets of elections, two pres and two midterms, even final week predictions for basically everybody, show me anybody who has gotten the last four elections, predicted them well. It functionally doesn't exist in the public space. Like people who got 2022, right?
Yeah.
They mostly got 2020 wrong as one of them, you know. And so I don't want to come on here and be like, oh, I know exactly what the turnout's going to be. And if you adjust from 2024 turnout or 2020 turnout to projected 2024, actually that's worth 1.4% for Biden or whatever. Like, no, it's a very fluid game. We've got one of the candidates on trial right now in New York. He might be falling asleep as we're talking, given that he's done it the last 2 days.
Yep.
In court. Like, some humility definitely is valuable from people, whether they, you know, got 2020 right or wrong, whether they got 2022 right or not. I think it's going to be interesting. I think it's definitely going to be close. But frankly, the reason I haven't really, we talked about this earlier, but like the reason I haven't really written about 2024 much is like, at this point, there's not a lot happening. There's a lot of things happening, but how much of it's important and super relevant?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, on the Wednesday show, my A block was about the trials and about, you know, I don't think that you can discount, at least based on the polling right now, that if Trump is on trial for something that is not clearly understood by the electorate, it seems to benefit him. It benefited him in the Republican primary. It benefited him in general election polls past a year ago when he first started getting indicted. We'll see whether or not that continues when he's actually on trial, whether it was something that was more of a possibility versus the reality. But let's get to a general prediction. We're not going to ask about who's going to win, but what do you, if you were to take a wild guess and say the demographic that will decide the 2024 election, what would you in pencil circle?
I'm going to say the suburbs, because the spoiler alert, global realignment guy is going to talk about the suburbs.
Here we go. We're playing the hits.
The drinking game can be found here. But the thing is, given that I don't believe that there's going to be huge amounts of shift amongst young voters and seniors, and I don't necessarily think Republicans are going to do that much better with minority voters than they did. I think you're going to do better, not that much better. You do get to a point where if Democrats gain another 6, 8, 10 points in some of these suburban counties in, Cobb and Gwinnett and even Forsyth in Georgia, in Maricopa, you know, they gain 4 points. The callers around Philadelphia and Wisconsin and Milwaukee, you're just looking at a situation where Trump needs a miracle to win. And if we think turnout is going to be lower, which I do, that probably doesn't help Trump. And so if the suburban trends continue, if the suburban realignment continues, if Democratic messaging on abortion is continuously effective, as 2022 showed it was, you know, you're looking at a situation where it's going to be very, very hard for Trump to win if Democrats can lock in those gains, especially if Trump doesn't have the time or the money to match Biden on the airwaves. Because, I mean, I think this Arizona Supreme Court decision is a nightmare for Trump.
Big time.
Wisconsin Democrats, you know, abortion's still on the line in Wisconsin. I think a national ban is really bad messaging for Michigan, where they just enacted a pro-choice ballot measure in 2022. Like, if Democrats can effectively reposition this campaign, if they can make the campaign about abortion, about reproductive choice, about the court and Trump's appointees and not wanting to let Republicans get another one, you know, you're really in a position where I think if the suburbs continue to move, the suburban voters that just won Biden a Senate majority in a midterm and gained them a seat, if that all happens again, Trump doesn't really have a lane. But that's assuming these trends continue, which I'm not assuming, but if it does happen, Trump doesn't really have a path back.
Yeah, and that's the things that we can't know going forward. Number one, I have not been blown away by the Biden campaign's messaging on this issue. I don't think it's great. I don't think that it's present. I think that it sounds very same-samey to the exact same message that I think some Democratic voters blame for getting them into this mess to begin with. And we don't know whether or not how present it's going to be. And that's the biggest thing that, you know, we'll see by the end of the summer, what the issues that are going to be talking about. But you have to wonder whether or not 2022 was the Dobbs election. And the further we get away from it, the more people tend to adjust to the reality that they're in.
That is a definitely the downside argument. And that is absolutely a potential thing. The problem is that Republicans do not seem to want to let this issue die. Right. Arizona Republicans don't seem to, you know, there was an immediate push from some Arizona Republicans to try and repeal the total ban and go
the Supreme Court law or the Supreme Court ruling, or to pass a new law that would supersede the one that they made before they became a state.
Right. Exactly. So there was an attempt to do that. They blocked it. I don't really know what the Speaker of the Arizona House is doing, if you'd like to keep your majority. But like,
yeah,
you've got Trump sort of hinting that he'd support a 15-week ban. I don't really even know why he said anything. Like, if you're not,
well, gonna, I mean, his stated thing is that it's not, that he's not going to make a federal thing. That was his move on Monday.
But like, just don't hold a press conference to not really say anything. just shut up then at that point, because at least then it's not a day worth of headlines with the words abortion in the headline. But like this is the point we made when last time I was on, when we were talking about immigration, right? If this election is about immigration, Democrats are going to lose, right?
Yes.
It doesn't really matter the positions they take. It doesn't really matter if Democrats are trying to moderate on the issue. That's not how politics works. If this election is about about Trump, Republicans are going to lose and Democrats are going to try and make it about Trump. And the one thing I'd say, yes, a lot of the Biden campaign's messaging sounds a lot like what Hillary said in 2016 about abortion, the court, et cetera, et cetera.
But Roe is on the ballot for real this time.
That was when Hillary was saying it was a theoretical problem, right? It was a theoretical risk. It is now an actualized problem created by Donald Trump. And I do.
Yeah. And that's the issue. The only problem is it's also a theoretical solution, because it's like, we're going to codify Roe. How? Explain to me on the map exactly how you codify Roe.
You and I have had this conversation before, and I agree with you on this. argue with you when you make this point. No.
Yeah. And that's my problem. My problem is that it's like, when you're even on the Sunday shows getting pressed on this, when on Meet the Press, Gretchen Whitmer is having to answer the question, okay, cool, we get your point. How do you do it? And she has to tap dance through it. And she's a good surrogate, so she's able to do it. How is that going to age through the summer? How is that going to go forward? And what I don't know about the Biden campaign, they don't strike me as particularly agile. They don't strike me as particularly inventive.
So I won't say they've been particularly inventive, but I mean, they have managed to gain 2 points in 5 weeks. Like,
yeah.
Which like is not the highest of bars by any means, you know, depending on the poll. I mean, they gained 3 in the New York Times CNS in February. Echelon last night came out with a 5-point swing. Like, which is not to say he's going to win the election. That's not the point. I'm not overreading polling in April, just because now it's better for the guy I support. But
yeah,
I am making the point that like Biden's campaign was left for dead by many in the mainstream media by the last time we talked about it. I mean, the last time we talked about it, the lead prompt we had was, should Democrats replace Biden? Or what do you make of the discourse that he should replace Biden? And now the media narrative is Biden's got the momentum. Like my main 2024 take at this point is stop overreacting. There are going to be good weeks for Biden. There's going to be bad weeks for Biden. There's going to be mediocre weeks for Biden. There's going to be good weeks for Trump, bad weeks for Trump, and mediocre ones.
Yes.
If we start making a momentum narrative based on, based on polling trackers, we're all going to lose our minds. We're all going to be in insane asylum by the conventions.
Yeah, I certainly think that you always want to look at these things with a grain of salt. You always want to understand the long view of it and the fact that a lot of the stuff that we care about now, we will care about differently or possibly not care at all by the time that November rolls around. But it makes sense to follow it on shows like this, especially with great guests like our friend Evan Scrimshaw. Where can people find your work, friend?
Political betting, NHL, maybe a bit of NBA at thelines.com, NFL when it comes back, obviously, but we ain't in football season right now. General political writing, mostly Canada right now. I am going to be ramping up America soon. I know I keep saying that. It's actually true this time. Scrimshawunscripted.substack.com. People who want more specific U.S. politics takes, me and my buddy Ryan Jakubowski did a draft of every toss-up House, Senate, and presidential race on my
YouTube
channel. That will be out by the time viewers are listening to this. Which I'm about to upload as soon as you and I are done talking. So if you really want to nerd out on like Don Bacon's chances of re-election, you can go listen to that.
Let's go.
Twitter at Scrimshaw. Follow me for shitposting and NHL takes.
Value in the NBA playoffs as you head out the door.
I mean, here's the problem. It's going to be Denver. So Denver at value.
So just ride Denver.
Yeah.
Just lay the juice and ride Denver and just don't think about it.
Yeah.
Just Joker, and move on.
Joker, Jamal, MPJ, like that team. They're too deep and they've got too many ways to score when one of those guys is having a bad night.
All right. Well, there we go. Thank you so much, Grim.
Thanks for having me.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. Politics, 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 written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. If you'd like to email the show, it is theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Follow and share video clips of the show at TikTok, Justin R. Young, Instagram, Justin R. Young, YouTube is Politics, 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 and Twitter is Justin R. Young. PX3podcast.com is where you can share this show with your friends, family, and clergy. Support us with a one-time donation. PayPal.me/PayJury. Venmo is Justin-Young-20. Cash App is PX3Cash. And you can send me anything you'd like in the mail. P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. Of course, there is only one place that you get bonus content, and that is TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts covering all the news that we miss on our free podcasting schedule, including the Thursday episode. Had an update on TikTok. That divestment might well happen. Our $10 tier gets you everything that we just talked about and your name read with the fine folks in the Titanic $10 tier. Sam, John, Niemeister, Edwin, and vote Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. Brian Edison, Jeremy, a dog named Checkers, Sarah, Jeannie, Matthew, Dr. G, Dustin, Brad, D-Laser, Nick, Just Another Pilot, Middle-Aged Mike, Utah Jimmy Montana, The Gen, Alo, D, Really, Andrew, Lisa, Fat Tony's PJs from New York, Devon the CFP, Gloria, Grayzone, Peepaw, Jay, Neil, John, DP4 Bongo, Neil, His Nerdiness Charles, Audrey Stole Adler Spot, Darren, Idris Arslanian, Berkeley Steven, Nomadic Terran, Molly's Delightful Demeanor, Adam, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul. There we go. You want your name read on the show. One place to do it, TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That wraps it up for the weekend. Thank you, thank you, thank you to all who support us. As we mentioned in the update, big week around these parts. We did announce that Ashley is pregnant. We are expecting our first child on Labor Day, and we could not be more excited here. But not only do we have a hot pregnant summer here in this household, we got a big campaign ahead of us. It's going to get hot. It's going to get sweaty. And oh boy, it's going to get nasty out there in the campaign trail. And I can't wait to bring you every moment of it. Till then, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, saying some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more, they're talking about politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss O3.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.